as we return to Dr. Future, hour number two, here on AM 1080 KSCO Santa Cruz. Thank you, son.
Welcome back to the second hour of the Dr. Future Show on KSCO.
Yes, we have some special guests in the studio. We have James Fadiman, PhD. He did his undergraduate work at Harvard and his graduate work at Stanford, doing research with the Harvard Group, the West Coast Research Group in Menlo Park, and Ken Kesey. That's back in the day, eh? Former president of the Institute of Noetic Sciences and a professor of psychology. He teaches at the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology, which he helped found back in 1975. He's an author of many books, including the latest one that just came out called The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide. Now, Jim, you've been through the whole cycle of psychedelia from when it first started in the 60s at Harvard, in this country at least, and all the way to through its ban and then to the, what's going on now.
Absolutely true, and it's good to be back.
Yeah?
That's right.
So what's happened? What changed in the last few years to create this renaissance?
Well, it's a really puzzling question. What happened to all this unnecessary repression of research? Mm. And my guess is that the people who passed all those laws out of fear are gone.
Really? So they're just natural...
Just attrition of idea. Aging, people who had an ideology that said, if I don't understand it, let's ban it.
I mean, like J. Edgar Hoover's and...
Similar. So the new people who are in legislative positions and so forth have no stake in it. They just are looking at it, is this useful, is this sensible? And then there's this thing happening in medicine called evidence-based science, which is you have to have some evidence before you can sell it or cut with it or use it. And psychedelics happens to fit very well as...
Real evidence, huh?
It's got a lot of evidence. Hmm. And it also has a huge number of people in the United States who've already used it. 23 million people have used LSD alone, according to the federal government, which suggests there's a lot of people who are not afraid of it.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people who have had personal experience and haven't spoken about it as well, right?
Probably a fair percentage of your audience right now is making that inner decision of have they ever spoken about it.
Mm-hmm. You'd say it's like talking about it as kind of like coming out of the closet for many?
It's a very different closet because there's so many people in it.
Right. 23 million. Well,
it's a clown closet.
But when you have written a book about psychedelics and you simply even walk around with the cover out,
yes,
the number of people who say to me, hey, man, I haven't done that for quite a while, but that was really good. People who otherwise would not have discussed it with me.
Yeah. So tell me about the Psychedelic Explorer's Guide. Did this come out of... personal vision of yours to share what you've learned in all these years of taking psychedelics and how it should be done right? Or,
well, a few years ago I started to write a memoir about all the interesting people I'd known and all that kind of thing and people that I'd taken psychedelics with and so forth and so on. And after about a year of actually studying my own era, because when you're living it you don't read the books about it because they haven't been written yet, I had this epiphany that said, who cares about Jim Fadiman? And it was this little teeny group. And then I thought, is there anything I know that people don't know and would like to know?
That you might be applied to more people.
And then I realized that I've worked in all these different areas of psychedelic research, and the top of the 23 million who are already have some experience, according to the federal government, 600,000 new people this year will try LSD for the first time.
How many?
600,000.
This year.
And I'd like them to do it well. I'd like them to do it safely. I'd like them to do it wisely. I'd like them to get what they're interested in doing, and I'd like them not to get in trouble. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the book is about sharing what we actually do know that works so that people will not only minimize harm, which a lot of people are interested in, but maximize benefit. These are super powerful tools, and why don't we use them well?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to ask you a question about this, Jim, in terms of people doing it safely. Now, these numbers that you're throwing out, these are huge estimates, and these obviously refer to people who are going to be doing it outside the purview of the law and the legal system.
Right.
Now, what do you think is going on in the legal system that is going to enhance the ability of people to learn safely about the chemical options that they have for consciousness experimentation?
Well, the legal system at the moment seems to simply be moving towards neutral. It's not putting out the same amount of totally erroneous information, which does get people in serious trouble. And on the other hand, the Internet is putting out a huge amount of information, much of it very sophisticated, a huge amount of it from people describing personal experiences to each other. So there's really a lot of information out there that is useful. And the letters I'm starting to get, and the book hasn't been out very long, are people saying, well, thank you for clarifying that what I've done was okay, or what I just did because I read your book and cleaned up part of what I was doing. So it's a little bit as if you put out a book on how to repair your car. The auto mechanics may not want you to have that book, but it empowers you to do things that make your life safer.
Now, you speak a lot about set and setting in the use of psychedelics, right, and how important that is.
Yeah, what I found is when I ask people who've had bad experiences, bad trips, what happened? And what I find, to my amazement, is almost everybody knows. And they immediately say, well, I was with the wrong people, I was in a bad setting, things were good until my car caught on fire. You know, wonderful problems that occur, and then you say, well, do you know how to do this right? And they tick off what we call set and setting and situation and sitter, which is, what's your intention? What kind of a place are you in? Is it a safe place? Is it a comfortable place? Is it a gentle place? Is it in nature? Who are you with? And I've found more and more and more that if you have a guide, if you have someone who's there not taking any psychedelic, who's simply there to make you safe, comfortable, and help you if you get in trouble, that's hugely beneficial. And then, of course, there's the substances. And there are different substances that are very different in the way they open different parts of the mind. And if you begin to take all that into account, it's a little bit like why people, on the whole, don't get hurt when they go in the surf. Because most people who go in the surf have a pretty good idea of the things that are generally valuable and also an idea of the things that make it a wonderful experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're seeing some parallels in that kind of thing as we have a whole generation now who have started taking LSD when they were...
Let's see, we have a member of the next generation here who
we'll
maybe
call
can...
him JC, 21 years old.
Yeah.
So he's fully legal.
Come over here to the microphone, JC. Jim, did you have a question in terms of, since we have JC here kind of representing the next gen of people experimenting with this enhancement technique?
Yeah, what my question to him would be is, what age did he first experience psychedelics, and what is the first age he would recommend that people should wait?
I guess my first LSD experience was probably 14, and it was with a very good group of friends, two of them, and it was a very amazing experience. It was very rich.
Was it guided?
No, it was all three of us in the same state, so there was no one on ground control, as a lot of people say. It was very mellow, but one thing that I noticed, especially after the many years that have passed, is that it was 8 hours of not really taking in stuff that I was going to use in the future. It was more about in the moment, kind of like almost like an art museum, just looking at beautiful things and examining things, but there wasn't a whole lot of active reflection and assimilation of information that had been processed.
Oh, this is just the most perfect representation of what I'm talking about, which is clearly what I'm hearing and what you're saying, and you're really almost saying it ideally, is if we'd had a guide, we would have learned more.
Very much so.
And what we know from the 30, 40,000 years of human experience, there are people who've used psychedelics. One of the common messages is you go out into this larger part of mind and you bring something back for the betterment of your people. That's not the same thing as tripping.
Very, very true. I would definitely agree with you on that one.
So that adds the sacred spiritual element to the equation.
Yeah, the full title of the book is Safe, Therapeutic, and Sacred Journeys, because there is an experience that people have, and the experience is of beginning to be aware of what I call the unity of all things, or the feeling that you are connected, and the realization and the understanding and the awareness that you actually are connected to all things. and that means to all other people as well as to the situation you're in. And when that occurs, the word sacred all of a sudden means something very different from 11 to 12 on Sunday in the church of your choice.
Hmm. Yeah, I wanted to point out, when you began your research, it was in the 60s, and it was before 1967 when everything became illegal. I think, just for maybe a little historical perspective, I'm curious, what did you think those early seekers believed about what they were getting into and why they would try it and what they were looking for?
Well, what happened for those early seekers, let's say the people at Harvard and people out here on the West Coast, and I worked with both groups, is what we realized is we did have that experience that I just spoke about, that feeling which is a kind of ecstatic joy that things are working together and that there are levels of awareness that are available to all human beings. So there was a kind of messianic zeal of how could you share that good news. The word gospel is being just good news. And so there was the question, and then how could you do that in a way that was not dangerous, that was not harmful, and also that wouldn't frighten people who were not having that experience.
And so what is it, where did the move to shut it all down come from in your direct experience? You know, and how did that affect your studies?
We were shut down in the middle of the first study using problem solving with senior scientists, where they were not getting off anywhere at all. They were working on their most pressing and most cogent hard science problems, and we'll talk about it after the break.
Well, we've got about 30 seconds. You might want to just mention some of those hard scientists that maybe people aren't necessarily aware of who did very well with their access to acid.
Well, I didn't run these two people, but Crick, DNA, Nobel Prize, he saw the double helix when he was on LSD. So that's one culture changer. Steve Jobs said it was one of the more important experiences of his life. That's another culture changer. There's one more Nobel Prize, and we'll take that one after the break.
To be heard after the break.
Right. Yeah. So you're with us on the Dr. Future Show on KCO. And call in 479-1080, Dr. Future Show.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. So, Jim, you were telling us about how you were shut down back in the 60s.
Right. We had four scientists in our other room lying down with headphones and music, and they were about to get up and start working on the problem that had obsessed them for at least 3 months before the session. That was kind of our rules of entrance. Mm. And we got a letter from the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, that said, as of the opening of this letter, your research license is terminated. And I was the youngest member of the group, and I looked around at my colleagues, thinking of these guys in the other room that we were about to go in and take off their headphones.
Well, you're serious? As of the opening of this letter? Something like that?
Something like that. And wow. I said, I think we got this letter tomorrow.
Yeah.
And indeed we did.
Great.
So, on the postal system.
Yeah, thank you, Sherry. Take a caller, son?
Sure. Very appropriately, this call is from Liberty. So, hi, Liberty.
Hey,
welcome
Liberty
to the Dr. Future Show.
Hi, good afternoon. Yeah, you had a guest on either last week or week before that was on a similar topic and wasn't able to call in. But I was part of that psychedelic revolution back in the 60s.
Oh, yeah?
I actually went quite a bit out of my way to get into it because I was living in West Texas at the time, and I sought out peyote, which was my first psychedelic trip, was on peyote. Oddly enough, in Texas at the time, it was legal to possess it. You just couldn't take it. So,
yeah, that's because of the peyote status of the church, right? There's
yeah,
a church.
Yeah, the Native American Indian church, yeah. So after I got out on the West Coast, I immediately sought out LSD and pot. My first trip was actually on Sandoz Pharmaceuticals, so uh-huh. I got the good stuff. But I remember back then that the whole East Coast Timothy Leary guided tour, have somebody, set and setting and kind of a semi-formal trip. And then out on the West Coast, along came
Ken Kesey.
Ken Kesey.
Yeah.
and the electric Kool-Aid acid test and people dropping acid
dancing
into Kool-Aid and people yeah. taking it without knowing it in party settings.
And very different scene, yeah.
I saw a lot of people that maybe their whole lives weren't ruined, but their lives were definitely turned around in what I consider to be a negative way for several years until they got their head turned around again. And I frankly think that it set my life back about 5 or 6 years because it was a lot easier to tune in, turn on, and drop out than it was to drop back in.
Well, let me drop in on you, and I'm glad you're still with us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think what you're saying is that those East Coast squares who said you ought to have a guide had something going.
Yep, that's right.
What we're finding in all the research that's being done now is there are people who are really seriously well-trained guides.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a lot of people around the country who very quietly are helping people who want to have such an experience, who sometimes call themselves guides as well.
Yeah, I think it can be a valuable tool, and I'm not saying that I didn't get anything out of it because it furthered my interest in Eastern religion, and I kind of consider myself a quasi-Buddhist at this point. But, you know, it can also really, really damage people. If the wrong people get a hold of it under the wrong circumstances, so I don't think it should necessarily be against the law. The libertarian in me says, no, it ought to be legal and accessible. But I'd like to see your book. I think it's great that maybe it's making a comeback and maybe lessons will be learned from the past.
Well, we always hope. Someone said if you don't learn from history, you can always try it again.
Yeah.
And the model I like is one that Ram Dass came up with that said it should be like learning how to fly a plane. Just don't go down to the airport and say, hey, I want to fly a plane. And they say, here, man, here, I'm tossing you the keys. There's a plane over there.
yeah.
They say, you want to fly a plane? The first thing you do is not fly a plane, which is you sit down over there in that little room and see that great big manual there. You got to understand it and take tests in it. And then after you can understand it, then you can go up in a plane with someone else doing all the driving, and gradually you learn to drive yourself, and you only do that when you're ready. It's not a bad system. And we haven't made flying illegal.
Yeah, and consciousness is sure as complicated.
I wish I could have gotten frequent flyer miles for all those trips.
I'm not sure what just happened. We lost you.
All those frequent flyer miles.
One of the things I'd like to say about Jim's book that I've read is that it really comes down to your setting and that what you want to get out of it and what you're looking for. If you go out on your own and you experience things on your own wildly, which is kind of what the Ram Dass quote, which is what, you know, I wasn't there, but this is Jim's, you know, writing, and then Ram Dass saying it, is that, you know, basically grass is like having a driver's license for a car. LSD, you have to have a pilot's license. So if you're going to go out, like Jim was just explaining, if you're going to go out and you're going to go fly that plane, you have to learn how to fly a plane. You can't just get in and do it. So, of course, if you're going to go in and do something, well, you have the instant potentiality of negativity and long-lasting negative effects because you don't know what you're doing. So in this instance, Jim's book, The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide, also Safe, Therapeutic, and Sacred Journeys Through LSD, really lays out how to properly do this with a guide and having a person be a guide so that your experience can be positive, enlightening, and you have different aspects of really understanding the different levels of yourself through these experiences by having someone there to ensure your safety and ensure that you yourself are actually growing from this experience and not just, you know, basking in the love glow that comes from a drug itself.
Mm-hmm.
So I definitely recommend The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide, Safe, Therapeutic, and Sacred Journeys as a must-read.
Absolutely. So we have some
look forward to checking it out.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Liberty.
We have a question coming in from JC here.
Well, yeah, I just wanted to add that I think it's really important to have this kind of material around now because not only are people still interacting with these substances, but now we've got a whole variety of research chemicals that have never been around on this planet until 20, 30 years ago. I myself have had a lot of experience seeing, you know, my peers experimenting with all sorts of varieties, and they
MDMA.
Well, no, further than that. I mean, MDMA is actually kind of a common one now, but you know, very exotic alphabet soup named drugs like 2CI and 2CB, which are much less common, but yet there are still people, psychonauts as they refer to themselves, that go out and seek these chemicals, and there's no foundation for understanding them or getting an idea of what that particular substance is going to be like. And there, you know, are a couple reference books by Alexander Shulgin, but other than that, there's a lot of just kind of
flying in the dark.
Exactly. Yeah. And not a lot of guiding to be provided.
This reminds me also, it seems to me a number of years ago up in San Francisco, we went to a conference that was called the Psychedelics Conference. Mm-hmm. And I think it was Aldous Huxley's wife was very adamant. She gave a panel about the fact that psychedelics had been used in many traditions in a very sacred way. And in particular, she, I think, had advocated the use, say, of peyote in childbirth. Mm-hmm. There are people who famously have gone out taking acid as they die. There are a lot of people who believe that there is actual benefit in using these consciousness-altering chemistries to do things that every human being does, and to do it in a more sacred way, and that it's actually advisable to do that with the proper recognition, the proper help.
Yeah, there's kind of strange to say, but there's a right way to do many things, and there's a lot of interesting wrong ways. And when you make sure that there's as little information as possible, the wrong ways get explored. And unfortunately, they get re-explored. And when Laura Huxley, you know, talks about its use long ago, at least in the Americas, what we do know is that we have definite evidence of peyote being used 7,000 years ago. And if you talk to the people who still use peyote as a central sacrament, like the Huichole, they say, you know, we actually have spent 7,000 years trying to make this work right. And we think we know more than you who started at age 14 with a good trip, but with total ignorance in a culture with not only ignorance, but kind of wrongheadedness. So the turnaround that this book and a lot of other books that are coming out now is to restore some kind of balance between people's desire to explore their own reality and the kind of foolhardiness that we all have, and it's not limited to the young, to take risks that are unnecessary.
I'd like to pick up on the word that you used, culture. And, you know, when we were talking before the show, you talked about endangered cultures, like endangered species.
Right.
Maybe you could speak a little bit about the role of culture in stewarding these experiences.
One of the issues that we have is how do you make use of and incorporate and bring into your own culture experiences which are far beyond the material world.
Yeah, well, what happens when people from different cultures all start talking to have God connection experiences?
You well, know, they, what's wonderful is yeah. people from different psychedelic traditions don't seem to ever argue about divinity.
Because it creates mm-hmm. Some commonality.
Well, it's as if you had people all over the Pacific Basin, from Asia to San Francisco, all go swimming. And then you say to them, is your ocean different from my ocean? And the answer is, in every way possible, at the most mundane and foolish levels. But as soon as you get past about 8 feet, everybody's ocean is the same. And so we have an enormous amount of cooperation and understanding between us. When you get lower down in any hierarchy, you get people whose interest in protecting their specialness is more important than understanding the way the world works.
Well, okay, so it gets everyone on the same page on being connected like that. So would you think it would help government if our Congress and Senate were able to have more cosmic experiences together before they made decisions? Would that make a...
Want to have an electric Kool-Aid test in Congress?
I have never advocated an electric Kool-Aid test before. However, given that people are treating each other as if they're a different species,
yeah.
it may be time to do something to bring back a recognition that at least we're all the same species. Mm-hmm. And that the other species need us as much as we need them. You know, somehow we have the notion that if we use something up, somehow it'll be replenished, like oil. Right. And it's no longer working. We're now at the maximum division from ourselves and nature that has probably ever been on the planet, and it simply isn't working. And one of the things that people who take psychedelics in every tradition say is it makes you more aware that you are not separate from, not dominant over, and not more special than, but part of a very complicated biosphere of living beings. And if we kind of go to the Dr. Future side, and we find out that in your stomach there are like 15 million different species of bacteria.
One of our favorite topics.
All the microbes that lead, that are in charge of us.
That run us all.
Well, that also weigh more than the rest of us. So if you take away our kind of microflora, we weigh about 40 pounds.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And so the notion that we need to learn how to live in cooperation with other species is built into every breath. Mm. And so the psychedelic people are saying, well, it's actually true along not only with the species in your gut, but the species across the dinner table and the species down the street and the trees in the garden.
Wow. Listen, let's take a minute here with our caller. We have Stephen from Illinois listening on the internet. Hi, Stephen. You got about 2 minutes before the break. Welcome to the Dr. Future Show.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me. I'm actually calling from Normal, Illinois.
Normal.
Oh, fantastic.
What a misnomer.
Yeah, tell our audience a little bit about Normal. I know who
normal.
You are.
The new normal.
It is hot here. I wish I was spending some time on the coast. It has been ungodly hot for the last 2 weeks. No. But the reason I'm calling is I was working with a friend of mine doing some, I guess you could call it psychedelic therapy. Mm-hmm. And I think it was interesting. The question that came up was, I want to learn how to feel like I do when I'm the substance we were working with was LSD. You know, that connect, you guys were just talking about the connectedness, the significance of every blade of grass, of every breath, of every person you encounter. I think that's one of the really powerful things of the psychedelic experience, is if you're looking to experience that connectedness, that togetherness, it's right there.
Right.
300 mics away.
Well, it's a breath away. And the question, it's the question that many people ask, well, okay, I had this experience and I understood this vast, interconnected, loving relationship that I have with the natural world, and now I'm not doing that anymore. What can I do? And I've gotten a couple of letters from people from different spiritual traditions that said, psychedelics are a wonderful way to make you aware of the possibilities that are inherent in your own being. And that the spiritual traditions, particularly the meditative traditions, will take you there slower, easier. And the nice thing with the meditation is when you are in that state, you can stay longer and it's much safer.
One person I've always listened quite a bit to is Terrence McKenna, and he talked about the ability that this has versus a meditation tradition. Like, well, what
Stephen,
can you show?
Let's hold this for after the break. We're just going to cut to a break right now, and we can talk about Terrence and those things when we get back, okay? Thanks for calling the Dr. Future Show. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Costa, host of The Costa Report. These days, you have a lot of radio programs to choose from, but here's why I'm asking you to turn your dial every Friday at 2 p.m. to KSCO. Because at some point, talk show hosts have got to stop raging, pontificating, and finger-pointing as if they're all auditioning for the Jerry Springer Show. That's right. In order to start solving our problems, we're going to have to tell our inner child to pipe down so our inner adult can take care of business. So join me every Friday at 2 p.m. right here on KSCO for The Costa Report.
Thank you, Rebecca, for reminding us we have an inner adult.
I need to take care of business.
Okay, so let's bring back in our Steve. Steve, you said you were from Normal, is that right?
Normal, Illinois, yep.
That's a place, huh? Okay. Yeah.
That's the name of the town. It's the home of Illinois State University.
Good to know. Okay, so we just have another caller on the line, but I think real quick we wanted to just give a little moment of acknowledgement to Terrence McKenna and something you were saying.
Terrence McKenna is
Stephen? Yeah, just real quick. I really liked something that he said. He would talk about how, you know, if you take a sufficient dose of a psychedelic, you will, you know, 99% of the time you will have a mystical experience. And when you look at some of the negative articles that came out of what the Good Friday experiments and the instant mysticism and all that, I think you realize that just because you have a mystical experience, it doesn't put you on a path to a spiritual life. And I think that's something that all people looking to expand their consciousness need to remember.
Yeah, good point.
That's really beautifully said. Houston Smith talks about it's not about a religious experience. Does it lead you toward a more religious life?
Yeah.
Thank you,
okay.
Steve.
Thanks for calling. Thanks, Steve.
Thanks for having the show, guys. Appreciate it.
Okay. So, hi, Dave Allen. Welcome to the Dr.
Hey, Fisher guys.
Hey there.
You were talking about the Terrence McKenna, right on. You know, a couple of years ago, I was sitting in the parking lot here a few minutes ago. You were talking about Ram Dass. And a couple of years ago, I watched this DVD he made called Defiant Spirit about his stroke and all this. Yeah, he had a similar stroke like I had, a brain hemorrhage. But he talks about back in the 60s, when he met an American guy that took him to Nepal, where he wandered up the hill 3 days fighting the Maharaji. He found the Maharaji, everybody's like kneeling down and, you know, prostrate to the guy. The guy said they're all these smiling, laughing. So he saw Ram Dass, he had another name. He named him Ram Dass, where he got the name from. And the Maharaji asked him, what type of spiritual experiences have you had? He goes, oh, Timothy Leary, the other guy, we take a lot of psychedelic mushrooms and LSD. And the Maharaji asked him, oh, what is LSD? I've heard about this LSD. So he pulled out a bag. He had like 23 hits in the bag.
Can I just interrupt you here, sweetie?
Yeah.
I appreciate your story, but could you make it real short? Because we have a few more things that we want to cover before the end of the show.
So the point is, Maharaji ate all 23 hits of acid.
Right.
Ram Dass said, oh, my God, you're going to fry his brain. The hour later, Maharaji goes, so what effect am I supposed to have?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. He's already there.
I built a little bit of a story to get a little background on that story. All right, it's a good show. I'll let you go.
Thanks a lot.
Open the doors.
Okay. And on that note of opening the doors, why don't we talk about Chapter 17 in the Psychedelic Explorer's Guide, The Inadvertent Pioneer, which is the author, James Fadiman, and his first experience.
It was inadvertent, was it, James?
Oh, it couldn't have been more inadvertent. I was, after college, I went and was living in Paris, and I was writing an extremely bad novel and thinking it was an extremely good novel. And my old professor, Richard Alpert Ram Dass, came to Paris on his way with Tim Leary and Aldous Huxley to go to Copenhagen to do their first public international conference about these substances. And my mentor said, the greatest thing in the world has happened to me, and I want to share it with you. And I looked at him, and he really seemed in wonderful condition.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, of course, what anyone would say is, sure. And then he reaches in his breast pocket and comes out with this little vial of pills. And I look at him, and I think, this is really weird. And he tells me that it's going to be okay, and I take a couple of a small amount of psilocybin, what we probably now call a moderate dose, and we're sitting in a cafe in Paris, and it's getting very bright, and it's getting very sparkly, and I'm hearing the conversations behind me, and my French isn't very good, but suddenly it's very good, and I'm not used to kind of overhearing everyone, and I say to Ram Dass, this is too much, and he says, why don't we go back to your room? He says, too much for me too, and I say, did you take anything? He said, no, this is my first time in Paris.
That's funny.
So we went back to my room, and during that evening, I simply began to reorganize how little I knew of reality and that there seemed to be considerably more. And from that very small beginning, my life changed, my career changed, my worldview changed, the way I treat other people changed. It was an inadvertent beginning. Then I ended up as one of the pioneers because there were very few of us doing this work.
Now, not to date you, but this was 1960?
This was 19... Oh, no, it was much later than that. It was 1961.
Okay. Much later.
So, Jim, as a psychologist, your center of focus besides this research is in the psychology of these experiences. Would that be a correct way of characterizing it?
I'm interested in all of consciousness, from the very depraved, pathological, to the very elevated, magnificent, creative. You know, I'm just as interested in what why people become people like this Norwegian, to why someone can become like the Dalai Lama, who says, I accept no solution for Tibet that would harm a single Chinese.
Hmm. Right. And so my question to you then is, you had this surprise experience that took you out of your center at the time of who you thought you were and caused you to reconstruct it. Now, what good is that? Like, why is that not a bad thing? Why, you know, people are talking about how it sets them back, et cetera.
Well, it's hard to explain when you have been a successful, arrogant twit, why letting that go is an improvement. But in a real sense, anything that increases your internal freedom and increases your awareness of reality inherently seems to direct people towards what we call the good. So that psychedelics in every culture have served the same point, the same kind of use in the culture, which is people who have these experiences are more likely to support that which is best in other people and good in themselves.
Thank you.
I'm curious, do you subscribe at all to Terence's thesis that that humans have different consciousness from the ape because of the ingestion of psilocybin on the plains of Africa?
I love it. I love the notion that all civilization rests in mushrooms that you pick from cow dung.
There's something romantic about that.
There's something that just, it's kind of the opposite of Genesis.
Why are humans different?
I'll tell you, we're really lighting up the boards here. You seem to have struck a chord. There are people calling in from Hawaii. Are you ready for another call?
I just wanted to introduce Nick Herbert to his friend, old friend of Jim's, is in the studio. And Nick is a quantum physicist, also from Stanford, who has embraced psychedelics. And these guys were at Stanford together when LSD first hit the campus. Hi, Nick.
Hi. But I couldn't afford LSD, so I took 300 morning glory seeds.
You went straight for the flowers.
And also, I'd like to say that as a really straight physicist, I would never do drugs. I didn't even, smoke. Or barely drank.
As a graduate student.
As a graduate student at Stanford. But mind expansion, I was seduced by a word. Mm. Timothy Leary's word, these are not drugs, these are mind expanders. And that's what I came to college for, was to expand my mind.
So it fit right in with your MO.
So, yeah, it did. Yeah. So I didn't take drugs. I took a mind expander. And it worked. So that's my pitch.
Thanks, Nick.
Right. There's a lot of people that don't like the word drugs, and I don't either, since they're confused with pharmaceuticals. Mm-hmm. But when you talk about morning glory seeds or cactus or ayahuasca or the 100 species, literally 100 different species of mushrooms, we're talking about something that is on this planet that is peculiar in that it seems to affect human beings in this way of mind expansion. And so I would say basically to Terence, the interesting thing is there seems to have been endless opportunities for human beings to try these substances wherever they were, and that every culture we know that exists in a place in which there are mind-expanding plants has used them. So there's something else to look at that in terms of what we talked about of what do cultures tell us. One of the things cultures tell us is that we have not yet found a culture that has felt that mind expanding is against their own culture.
Mm-hmm. So it's pretty standard species behavior then, in that respect.
Seems to be.
And on the mind expansion part of it, I'd also like to maybe touch base at some things that you wrote in your book, The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide, that there are different levels of taking these particular substances to achieve different goals.
Yeah, let me very quickly, because a lot of people in this audience actually know a lot of what we're talking about.
And we have some callers, too.
Yeah.
Which is what's called a high dose or entheogenic or going for spiritual experiences, relation to the divine. That's in the 400 microgram range. When you get to 200 micrograms, you're talking in the psychotherapeutic range where people can truly have significant breakthroughs. It's where the work was done with alcoholism. and many other mental concerns. And if we go down to 100 micrograms, there's some serious work, mainly reported in my book, of this hard science, hard problem solving. And then there's a relatively new area, which is called tenors, or 10 micrograms, sub-perceptual dose, which is, it doesn't interfere with anything you're doing, but people are reporting that it acts like a cognitive enhancer, only it seems to enhance all the other chakras as well. So those are the kind of basic outlines of where we're now working at all these levels.
Interesting. Okay, well, let's go to a call, and boy, we could talk about this all day. Here we have Trey in Hawaii. Hi, Trey. Did I get your name right?
Aloha. Thank you, everyone, for
Aloha, Trey.
Doing what you're doing and continuing the good work. I wanted to briefly go on the subject of listening earlier as somebody who was presenting the younger generation and not having a guide. I also, from the younger generation, have, at the age of 14, actually had the option of taking the medicines or, mind expansion option. And it presented itself in a way where I actually looked at it as I'd rather read more. And I turned into more of, was given to a book by Timothy Leary, Politics of Ecstasy, which took me into a deeper realm of understanding. Since then, being raised in Hawaii and being very close with nature, learned to know that one of those people actually is now Ram Dass, lives very closely on this island. And I've been coming and gardening with him for some time and just learning some of those ways. And actually, the way that I first experienced was not through a guide, but it was also just what you were speaking on, which is more of a low-level dosage, 100 micros or less, and finding my set and setting where I was comfortable, and also speaking with my partner's grandmother this morning on this subject before I even knew that this was going on and the broadcast was happening. She happened to tell me how she was going into her set and setting the first time, which was she was actually raised in Texas as well, which I heard a caller, and I've come to the point where she didn't want to be in the setting of a room with a clock. She wanted to be out in her forest next to her garden. So I'd like to ultimately get some advice, giving you the background from where I'm at. Where is it that you'd like to see this younger generation holding space within all the festivals and culture that we have right now?
Great question, Trey.
How is
Thanks
it that we
so
can
much.
Ultimately serve our greatest community, which is this cause?
Okay. I'm going to put you on hold here and just remind everybody that we have about 2 minutes left to finish up the
show. The end of the show.
So.
Yeah, well, Burning Man sold out.
So, but to Trey's question.
Trey's
you know?
Question is, do it the way your grandmother tells you. The grandmothers know. The spirits know. The great spirit knows. And it's important that you always, if possible, be in touch with nature. And at festivals these days, usually there's some group that'll help people who are getting in trouble. And it's really important to know who they are before you go. And to take care of yourself and to take care of anyone with you.
Yeah, and I think those are all really good advice. And something that I say also to people who even have issues with tobacco or alcohol or any kind of mind-altering chemistry is that remembering your sacred ways and that you are using the substances consciously can make a great deal of difference in the way that you relate to them and the experience.
To quote okay. Albie Hoffman really
one
quick, he
minute.
Said, always use it in nature.
Yeah. And let me ask you, since we have the two scientists in the room, do you think there might be such a thing as a, now I'm half serious about this, a cosmic Google, like a way of talking to nature where we get real information?
There's actually been a wonderful study of someone who took scientists down, gave them ayahuasca. They asked ayahuasca their hard science questions, protein synthesis, you know, that level of question.
Yeah.
Each of the scientists felt they got an answer that moved their research forward.
Wow.
So nature's been doing biochemistry a lot longer than MIT or Caltech.
Okay, thank you. As to Jim Fadiman, Psychedelic Explorer's Guide. Thanks for tuning in to Dr. Future Show.
Well, I'm glad we lit up the board.